This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. I'm here on Saturdays at this time every week, and we talk about the disease of addiction and the road to recovery. Now, we know, because it's now finally bubbled up into the mainstream media, incessantly reminding us that this country is in the grip of perhaps the worst drug epidemic in its history. So, yeah, that story's out there. And now, lo and behold, it's being treated more honestly than it has ever been as a medical problem. So we know that story, and we it's important to tell it. But Recovery Radio is about the other part of that story, and that is, in spite of all of that, people get sober. They do. Millions of people in this country are living in long-term successful sobriety. So it's important that we let you know that's possible, and that these are some of the ways people have achieved it. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. They are critical to helping us tell that story. Today we're going to bring you yet another in a series of interviews we've been bringing throughout the months here on Recovery Radio of folks who are in long-term successful recovery. They are sober, many for the first time in their lives, and they are here to tell us that story, how they got there, how they're maintaining their sobriety, and the role that Retreat's alumni organization helps in that effort. So we begin these programs by saying hello once again to Maggie Hunt, who is the driving force behind this. Hi, Maggie. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Maggie is the what was that fancy title they gave you? Come on, tell me.
Corporate Alumni Officer is the actual title. Well, however it is, it's fine.
I like that title. Tell us about the alumni group.
So everyone who leaves Retreat is automatically an alumni of Retreat. So we just want to celebrate their milestones and piggyback on their recovery and share the hope to get away and stop the stigma of, you know, all of the terrible overdoses. And, you know, we hear a lot about the opiate epidemic, but we hear a lot about the negative side. You don't really hear as much about the recovery side, and that's what we want to voice. That's what we want to show.
And it will become apparent, it should, if it's not already to you, why something like an alumni group is not only maybe an obvious thing to form, but one that can have incredible therapeutic benefits, because support is key to maintaining sobriety. So we have an alumni, and
yes.
That is, who is it today?
Sarah Naylor. And Sarah is an active alumni member. She comes every week. Whenever I call and ask for her support, she is there, and she is very influential with other people. She also, like, other people will go places if she's going to be there. I've been able to see her process from the first time that she was ever at Retreat, because I had a different role at that time, so I can speak to the miracle of her story. I'll introduce you to Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Welcome to Recovery Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we're going to get into your role there with the alumni group a little later in the program, but, you know, we want folks to know who you are. So tell us who Sarah Naylor is.
Okay, so my name's Sarah. I was born in a little suburb of Philadelphia. I grew up in a town called Conshohocken. Some people know what it is. They know it's like that sign, like right before Manayunk and such. I can say that, you know, growing up, I always felt a lot of times, like, when I was telling my story, like, at meetings and such, that, like, my story didn't count because, like, I didn't have a traumatic childhood. Like, I had a wonderful childhood. I grew up with a bunch of kids running around this little private street that I lived on. There's a little park, like, right across the street. We had fun. And, like, my parents, like, they showed up. They were there, you know? I had everything I could have asked for. I had, you know, like, I played sports every season. My parents were at every back to school night. You know, I loved school. I loved just being in a mix of all the chaos. That's something that had never changed. And whether that chaos was good or whether that chaos was bad, like, I just loved being, you know, in the middle of everything. Mm-hmm. And, that that really helped with this. You know, I have a really big, like, extended family. You know, I grew up, the way I grew up, like, the street I lived on is super close, right? And they, like, I have aunts and uncles that I call aunts and uncles that aren't necessarily related to me, but, like, I consider them closer than my actual family, like, at times. And they showed up for me as well. And, like, so, like, besides the family aspect, like, school, you know, I mean, I was, like, a normal kid in school. I definitely, like, got in, like, a little, like, trouble, like, just being, like, a little mischievous all the time. I have an older brother.
I was going to ask you about your siblings. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I have an older brother. His name's Steven. He's, like, super great. He's 3 years older than me. So, like, in school, like, you know, in, like, elementary school and such, like, we were, like, super close. And he was just, like, you know, like, the role model older brother that, like, you want to be just like. You want to be, like, I was, like, a little tomboy when I was a kid. So I always wanted to, like, you know, like, play, like, rough football and stuff with him and his friends. And, you know, like, it was always, like, a good time. There's always people around. That's, like, one thing that, like, I definitely remember, like, distinctly. Like, there's always people.
Was there any substance abuse in your family background?
No. I mean, my poppy, which is my dad's father, I can't call him an alcoholic. I can't define anybody else. But he was more like a drunk. Like, he drank every day, but I've never seen that man drunk, like, one day in my life. Like, right. That's just how he functioned. He was a functioning, you know, alcoholic. And, right, like, but in my immediate family, no, there wasn't. You know, my dad rarely drank. My mom would drink on occasion when, you know, we had some people over or something.
I ask that question because you have already painted a picture of what in the past would have been thought of as the least likely person to wind up messed up on drugs and alcohol.
Right? Absolutely.
But now, we know one of the reasons that the current drug epidemic has gotten the country's attention is that the notion of who a drug abuser is has been shattered once and for all. It is, tragically, folks just like the people you just like what you described.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with that 100%.
So if I hear you correctly, Sarah, the message here is this shouldn't have happened to me, but I'm telling you it did.
Yes.
Right?
100%. I couldn't say it better myself.
All right. There's no other way, and it's a terrifying thought. Again, it's both terrifying. My experience has been terrifying, and people are still in denial. They look at this problem, and they think, this couldn't happen to us. This can't possibly happen to us.
Yeah.
But it can. It can. Did you at any point, and we're going to get into the history of your substance abuse a little bit later, so I don't want to get there yet. But when you talk about you had a wonderful childhood, you speak so affectionately of the people around you. When you descended into the abuse, how much guilt did you feel? I mean, you didn't have anything you could blame on this. I mean, did you feel the sense of why, you know, this shouldn't be happening to me, these wonderful people, look what I'm doing to them? Why did you feel that, and why didn't it stop you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of, like, guilt and shame and, you know, all of that. And I don't think anything really could have stopped me. Like they say in the big book, like, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. And, like, that just means, like, all of your, like, your parents crying, you know, like, even, like, a PO or something, like, nothing's going to stop you until you make that choice, like, on your own. And I know it's not a choice to, like, pick up and use, like, every day once you're in, you know, like, full force active addiction, but it does, like, at a point, like, you can't stop. It's almost like survival mode. And it's like, how did I get here and how do I get out? And it's a terrifying place to be. And, like, you do feel all of that, but that's why, like, you use the next one because you don't know how to make that go away without Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps.
Sarah Nagler is our guest on Recovery Radio this week. Sarah is now 16 months into her sobriety, and she's taking us through her background as a kind of typical young girl growing up in suburban Philadelphia caught up in the grip of this disease. Sarah, we're going to take a moment here to talk about how you're introduced to drugs. At what point, how old were you, and what were the circumstances of your introduction to either alcohol or drugs?
My first introduction to any kind of substance was alcohol. And it actually, it happened, like, you know, on that little private street that I talked about. Like I said, my brother and my cousins, like, they were, like, a couple years older than me. And it was New Year's Eve, and we always had, like, these little block parties. And I just remember seeing, like, the adults and, like, you know, like, older kids, they were drinking, like, these, like, rum runners. And they're, like, slushies, and, like, they have alcohol in them. And I just see that as a, you know, 10, like, 9 or 10-year-old, like, kid. And I'm like, oh, I want that. Like, that's cool. Like, that's what the older kids are doing. So, you know, like, we, like, sneak one, we get one, and, like, we're all, like, you know, off the park, and we're drinking it. And all I remember is, like, drinking this and, like, wanting to, like, drink it all because, like, they think it's, like, so cool. And, like, from the first time I took an alcoholic drink, before I even knew, like, the, like, what it would cause in me, like, what switch it was going to turn off, like, I was already, like, chugging this thing, like, thinking it was cool before I even felt the effects or knew what the effects were going to produce for me.
Do you remember?
And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Nothing. I did that, and that's the first time that I was ever introduced, and, like, I did. I loved the way it made me feel. And some people talk about they didn't like the taste, it was disgusting. Well, my first drink was, like, pretty dang good.
Yeah.
So.
Did you notice in any of your peers that they also similarly liked it from the first time they tried alcohol? Or were you different? Or were you unique that way?
I'm not. I mean, I don't think they like that switch went off. Like,
yeah.
I was with, like, family at that time, and, like, they kind of just did it, and, like, I don't think they really thought about, like, the next time they were going to do it. But, like, I know in my head, I was like, this has to be, like, a thing that happens again.
Yeah. The reason I ask is that it would be incredibly helpful if young people, and you were what, 10 or 11?
Yeah.
It would. I know maybe this is impossible, but it would be very helpful if young people at that level could be told that if and when you experiment with alcohol, if you find that you like it almost immediately, tell somebody. And
yes.
Not, don't tell your friend. Tell an adult. Say, you know what? I snuck some alcohol, and I just loved it immediately. Because that's a significant difference. So it's interesting that you bring it up. Sarah Naylor is our guest. She is an alumni of Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Center. She's here to tell us about her history of substance abuse and then her eventual road to sobriety. This is Recovery Radio. We have more. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. On the telephone with us is Sarah Naylor. Sarah is going on 16 months or thereabouts sober. I know I'm being imprecise here, and it's not right, but I apologize ahead of time. She is in successful recovery now. She is an alum, a member of the alumni group at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Center, is the sponsor of our program here, and she's been telling us about her history of substance abuse. So I have long since, Sarah, stopped being taken aback when I hear that people began their problems with drugs or alcohol as young as 10. You're not even the youngest person I've interviewed. I remember we had an 8 or 9-year-old story once. It's remarkable. And I'm particularly fascinated by, you know, this story about the minute I had it. The minute I had alcohol, I knew it was for me. Take me through that process. You're 10, 11 years old. And through your subsequent history of drug use, where did it lead you?
So, you know, like, after that first drink, at being, like, you know, 11 years old, it's not, okay, I'm going to drink every day for the rest of my life. It was just, I really like how that made me feel, and I like being cool with the older kids, so, like, this is definitely going to happen again, and I'm going to make that, like, one of my missions. So I continue, like, you know, just to be a normal kid. Like, I don't think about it every day, but I'm just, like, being a normal kid. So, like, that takes me to, like, you know, up until, like, the summer of, like, 8th grade. So at this point, I'm 14 or 15. And, like, now, like, my peers, like, not just, like, my older, like, family members, like, that I see around, like my peers are, like, starting to, like, get into this kind of thing. Like, you know, marijuana and things of that sort. And, you know, like, I was like, I want to do that too. And, like, at this point, like, sports are, like, coming into play, like, a lot more than before. Like, you know, lacrosse was my main sport, and, like, I played field hockey, but, like, lacrosse was, like, priority to me. And, like, that's, like, one thing that, like, I always took pride in, like, was, like, playing lacrosse. And, like, soon, like, that would change because of the influence that drugs and alcohol like were having on me.
What do you mean change? Did you leave athletics behind or
no? I played up until, you know, like my senior year. Okay. And like then like I threw like all of that away. Mm. Like eventually, you know, like I could have like went to like college and like played and like been successful with it, but in turn of like getting in trouble and like, you know, like not being able to put that last one down, like when I could have like took that like next step and like been something and done something with it, like I wasn't able to differentiate like whether I should put that one down or like whether I should like succeed in lacrosse for the rest of my life.
Right.
But like we know what choice I made.
Were you aware at any point that you were going harder than everybody else, or did you just surround yourself with people who were also going hard?
No, I was like very aware of it because, you know, I was kind of like that closet addict, like for a little bit at least, until I couldn't hide it anymore. A lot of the time, like my friends were like normal kids, like doing the same things I was doing, playing sports, you know, like doing good in school academically, like AP classes, like these kinds of things. But then I was just the one that had to leave school every day, every single day, and like go smoke a little bit. And I was the one that every day after school, I'm like, you know, like selling it to my friends. I'm like doing all of these little things that like they're not doing, right, that I know like is making my addiction like progress like a little more each and every day.
Did your reputation change as a result of your behavior?
Absolutely. It did. I was, you know, in my, like, I'm just going to tell you one quick little story. Like, at the end of my junior year of high school, I played varsity lacrosse from the time I was a freshman. And, like, you know, sports are really, like, important in our school. And we, like, get praised for, like, playing sports. And I was in, like, AP classes up until, like, you know, junior year. Like, I'm supposed to get expelled because, like, they found, like, a very large, like, lump sum of marijuana, like, in my car on grounds. And my coach actually being the correctional officer for the school, it kind of ended up being a slap on the wrist because they didn't want me to not be able to play lacrosse. So, like, instead of getting expelled like most kids do, like, not going back to the school, they kind of sent me off. They're like, okay, you're going to be suspended for 45 days of your senior year, and then you can come back. And that's probably the worst thing that ever happened to me because those 45 days I ran wild.
Wow, that's sort of a textbook example of how not to handle that problem, right?
Yeah,
I mean that's extraordinary. Was there anything in your behavior, particularly in your high school years, that looking back on, and I don't mean this to be an indictment of your parents or you casting any blame on them, but is there anything that you were doing that they should have noticed was wrong or not your typical teenage behavior? Was there anything they should have noticed that they didn't?
You know, I think that as addicts, we're very good manipulators. And anything that they did notice, like such as like, you know, my attitude, my who I was hanging out with, things like that, like I would lie. So if they thought that they noticed something, I would twist it into this like magnificent lie that like they were like, well, she can't make that up.
Like, how'd you lie about a 45-day suspension for
like that? Okay, so at this point I'm like smoking weed and doing all these things, and like they see how I'm doing in school, like, okay, she's in AP classes, she's still playing lacrosse, she just got caught up, you know, with like the wrong people, like smoking some weed, and like this is going to teach her, kind of thing, you know. Like, any normal student, I think that would have taught them, like, you know, this is wrong, stop doing that. And at that point, I think that I was just running on my will. It didn't matter what my parents said. It didn't matter what anyone said. I just kind of had my own thoughts, and I was going to do what I wanted to do, and they couldn't have stopped me.
Sarah Naylor is our guest. She's telling us about her substance abuse beginning at a very early age, and she's going to bring us up to speed on where that took her. Now she's in sobriety and sharing her story with us on Recovery Radio. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We have this week yet another in a series of programs we like to bring you periodically about people in successful sobriety, how they did that. They are members of an alumni group put together by our guest here in the studio, Maggie Hunt. Maggie's responsibility, among other things, at Retreat is to keep this group and form this group and keep this group going. And she provides us with members of that group. And she's got a great one, wrote a great one with us on the telephone, Sarah Naylor, who is 16 months now in sobriety. And a little bit later, Maggie will tell us up from a real unique perspective how she's seen Sarah go through her struggles with substance abuse and sobriety. So, Sarah, take us through. So you very quickly, you're a young girl, you very quickly go from youthful indiscretion with marijuana and alcohol to a full-blown addictive problem that culminates, I guess. Well, you tell me, what kind of drugs did you race through?
Started with cocaine, you know, every here and there. I would do it before games, this and that. It had, like, a good effect. I liked it. So I started to do that. I started, like, through, like, you know, like, selling a little weed, like, got involved with these people, like, that were doing, like, other things. And they were doing pills, like, as we know, like, opiates, like, Percocet 30s. And I started, like, doing them. And then, like, before I knew it, like, I didn't know the consequences of, like, you know, withdrawal, like, all these things that they had. Like, I thought I was just doing it because, like, I could. And, like, I thought it was cool. And before I knew it, like, you know, like, the boy I was with at the time, I definitely, like, got hooked on them. And the way he was doing them, I was doing the way he was. And he had been an addict for years in the making. And I'm just this, you know, like, 17-year-old girl, like, soon to be 18, that, like, has no idea, like, what world she's getting herself into. And, like, that's through, like, you know, like, my friends weren't doing those things. Like, I, like, met this other group of friends that were, and they were much older than me. And, like, I had no business doing it because, like, I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
It's another thing people on the outside don't understand about people in the grip of this disease. Why don't they recognize it sooner? But Sarah said it, and I've heard it so many times. You just change the context you live in. Mm-hmm. You're not hanging around with people that are sober. You're hanging around with people that are getting high. So everything sort of mm-hmm. looks normal. You've seen this. Sarah has said the same thing we've heard from others. They did some of these drugs, particularly stepping up, because they thought they could.
Yeah, I talk about it as, like, excluding witnesses, right? So you don't want to have anybody around you who's going to, like, ruin your high and tell you that you should stop doing what you're doing because you don't want to, right? So you got to, like, exclude these witnesses. You don't want anybody to see what you're doing because you don't want to have to be responsible for any of those things. So, like, you know, I'll just switch groups. My life becomes the only normal one, and I associate myself with people who also have a normal life using heavy amounts of drugs as I do.
Seem perfectly normal. Sarah, when tell us about the first time you decided that this isn't working and I got to get into treatment.
The first time I decided that, I believe I was 19 years old, and it was my second DUI within a 3-month period. And, you know, it wasn't my choice. I didn't decide that it was a good choice to go to rehab. I called my parents from the Roundhouse for the second time after I swore after the first DUI that this wasn't going to happen again and this and that, came back their trust, get my car. Before you know it, I had my second DUI. I'm calling them from, you know, the Roundhouse. And I just hear my dad in the background. And he says, you're not coming home unless you go to rehab, you know. And that's how I decided. And I came home and they're looking at Retreat videos of, you know, like the people at the Retreat and how it changed their life. And I was like, well, I guess if I'm going to go, I'm going to go there. So that's the first time I went to treatment.
So let me ask Maggie, did you remember when she, were you at Retreat when Sarah first showed up?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And she was the typical, you know, still holding on to delusions and still holding on to the past. So she would say, you know, my life, you know, it's not really that bad. And I would say to her, Sarah, there's not a lot of 19-year-olds who have had 2 DUIs in the past 3 months. You know, like she wants to pretend, we want to pretend and we want to believe that our life doesn't look like this. So, you know, the progression of that changed significantly. But the first time she was in, she was very, you know, little Miss Innocent.
Sarah, at that, you remember that, of course. Did you think you were actually getting over on these people when you first got to treatment? Did you really think all that stuff was working?
Oh, absolutely. I thought I had them wrapped around my finger. I did.
And you would just
I knew that it wasn't true.
And you would just play this game and then you would get out and use again, right?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really the plan. But I did get out, and I was like, I'm going to, you know, Maggie tried to tell me, why are you trying to recover? I'm like, oh, no. Like, I have to go home. I have to go back to, like, you know, I have to go back to school. I have to go to college, and, like, I have to do all these normal things, and, like, it's going to be great. And she was like, okay, like, sounds good. And, like, I guess she knew at the time that I would be back in no time, but I didn't know that.
Is that right?
I mean, I was hoping. Sure. I always hope. Like, I hoped. But there was a lot of delusion that you sense a little bit. So,
how did it work out, Sarah, that first time? How soon after leaving treatment for the first time were you back using?
It was probably, like, you know, maybe 2 weeks. And at this point, like, I was, like, using, like, heroin, like, not IV, like, yet, but I was, like, using heroin, like, regularly again, and, like, it happened overnight, and, like, the people I was hanging out with changed again, and, like, it was just not, like, a good scene to be in. And, yeah, I mean, that went on for, like, a little while, probably, like, 6 or 7 months, maybe.
It's still remarkable, even after having heard hundreds and hundreds of these stories and read a lot on the disease, that people in your circumstance and other people would descend, is the only word I can use, descend into the use of heroin. I mean, heroin is a different, taken from somebody who's never tried it, but it's a different magnitude of order here. What starts out as fun, recreational, almost typical behavior, let me smoke some pot, let me have a beer, when it gets to heroin, It's as I said, a different thing. How long were you abusing heroin, Sarah?
Up until, you know, my clean date, which is June 4th, 2016. And, you know, there was spurts of sobriety in there, like 3 months here, a month here. But and, up until then, like that, and that's the only solution I knew.
And during your, as I said, descent into heroin abuse, you're in and out of rehab again, right? So let me ask Maggie. Maggie sees you come in as a young, sort of smart aleck girl who's got some kind of DUI problems and some kind of drug problems. And the next couple of times you see her, she's a full blown heroin addict, right?
Yeah. And the progression was pretty quick. It was as if she went into treatment with like an associate's degree in like substance abuse, and left with a master's degree in heroin. Very quickly.
Can you appreciate that description of yourself, Sarah?
Absolutely.
So you're not a stupid girl. I mean, you're not a stupid woman. I can hear that. You're not dumb. And none of the folks I talk to who wind up abusing heroin sound like they're dumb. When did you realize that you were now using drugs in a completely different context in which you started using drugs? When did that happen?
Probably like, you know, the first time, like I got out of rehab and like I picked up again and I was like, why am I doing this? You know, like now I'm doing it. Like, I'm like, it was just a feeling after getting out, like thinking that like that was going to cure me. Like I just needed to go through the withdrawal somewhere, not at my house. And like, once I picked up, like after being sober, you know, almost like 2 months, cause I was in there for 30 days. I get out, I make it like 2 to 2.5 weeks. I'm like, wow, like, I seriously have a problem. Like, I am, like, choosing to do this drug, like, sober. Like, something's not right. And, like, I was scared at that point. But, like, the only thing to do was, like, pick up the next one and, like, make that feeling go away.
What were you scared of? Were you scared of dying? Were you aware that you might die?
No, that wasn't a thought yet, probably, until, like, that actually, like, occurred, like, later on, like, in my story. Mm-hmm. But, like, I was scared that, like, I, for once, like, realize that like I didn't have control.
That's a very key insight, isn't it, to have, because
yeah.
the rest of the time, in fact your entire history, no matter what you were doing, you always thought you were calling the shots, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
And when you realize you're not, that's a very, you know, when they talk about a bottom, that could be one of them where you go, you know what, I can't control this. Now let me ask you about, so you're in and out of rehab. Now that you have achieved some sobriety for a long period of time, what was it, do you suppose, about the final time in treatment that took hold and seems to be working? Do you have any idea of that?
You know, I think what it was, I don't think it's anything that anyone said or anyone did or I did. I think it was just that every other time, like, people, like, spoke about this, you know, like, gift of desperation. And, like, every time I went into treatment, I was like, am I desperate enough? Like, am I, like, and I would question it. And then this time, like, when I walked in there and, like, I knew all the CAs at this point, I'm like, what is my life? And, like, what can I do? Like, I was desperate. And, like, I didn't question it for once. And, like, I knew that, like, something had to change or, like, I was going to die because at this point I had overdosed 4 times. And I just knew that there was no, it was either I was going to die being a drug addict or, like, I was going to change something.
I think it's the first time I've heard that expression, the gift of desperation. Maggie, when people get to a retreat, and even having been there a couple of times, are you aware that they're closer to that point?
Yeah. I think that there's definitely things that they say, actions that they you know, portray that you can kind of tell. It's almost like they run out of options, and you almost can feel it when you talk to them that they are just sick and tired of being sick and tired. I hate that cliche,
sure. But
it's so it's literally so true.
And I suppose more inclined to listen to somebody else. Okay, I don't know the answers. Maybe you do.
Yeah.
Did you have that thought, Sarah?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think much happened when I was in rehab because I was only in there 10 days the last time in treatment. And I didn't want to listen to anyone. I still had that mindset. But the second I got out and I was sitting on the porch of my recovery house and I called I just took a suggestion. I listened to someone. They said, hey, why don't you call this woman? She might be able to help you. And I just called her and I cried and I didn't know who it was. And I let my pride go and I let my ego go. And I just said, I need help. I don't know what to do.
16 months later, you join us now clean and sober. We want to talk about that period of time in your life when we come back on Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martoreno. I want to remind you that if you have any questions or comments about anything you have heard about this disease or treatments that are available, Retreat is ready to answer those questions for you. I give you the phone number. We hope you never have to use it, but it could come in handy. 855-859-8808. That's how to reach them. 855-859-8808. Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. From that organization, the head of their alumni group, Maggie Hunt, joins us. She's been in the program many times. She brings with us a member of the alumni group to share with us that story of sobriety. Sarah Naylor is our guest on the phone. Sarah, you know Maggie, you know her well. She spoke with great affection at watching your history of multiple times in and then finally getting sober and how enthusiastically you've embraced the alumni program. Let's talk about your sobriety now. It's quite an achievement for someone even as young as you are. Are you confident are you strong and confident in your desire to stay sober?
Absolutely. You know, but I think that it also has nothing to do with me. And, like, it's through, like, this program of, like, the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and, like, a power, like, greater than myself that, like, keeps me sober and, like, keeps me balanced every day and, like, keeps me, like, where I'm supposed to be because it's not always, like, 100%, like, you know, like gung-ho recovery, like life shows up sometimes and, you know, you don't want to give up, but like, you want to be like, you know, like this is hard. This is, you know, I remember at a year sober, I was like, you know, this is really hard because like, we're used to like drowning everything out. And like, now I'm like taking care of all these things, like running a recovery house, like 2 recovery houses. And like 19 girls are depending on me. And, like, I'm like, I couldn't even depend on myself, you know, a year ago. And now all these people are depending on me. And it gets hard sometimes. But I'm, you know, absolutely, like, confident that, like a power greater than myself always has my back. And, like, I always figure it out. And, like, things always, you know, like, turn out exactly the way they're supposed to be.
Yeah. I've grown to appreciate and perhaps even understand when I hear people talk about that greater power and it's not them. But I'll ask both of you, I'll ask Maggie here first. It is Sarah. Sometimes it's Sarah that's staying sober, right?
Yeah. Well, she's putting one foot in front of the other. That's what she's doing.
Yeah. So, you know, I hear you. And there's obviously you know, strength and truth in that for people. But, you know, you really are doing this. Sarah, I can hear it in your voice. You're sort of, are you still sort of amazed that you're sober?
Yeah, absolutely. Every day, like, not every day, but sometimes I'll just be laying in my bed, like, after work. And it's like, wow. Like, they said, like, life beyond my wildest dreams, right? And, like, I thought that was, like, a mansion, a nice car, like, all these things. And, like, my perspective on that has totally changed. And, like, I do live a life that, like, I could have never imagined. And it's a beautiful, like, a beautiful thing. It really is. It's, like, just so simple, but, like, I'm grateful for it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, this is, like, a great thing. Like, I show up for my parents, and, like, you know, like, my family is, like, part of my life, and it was so important. Like, you heard how I talked about at the beginning of the story, and, like, I lost, like, sight of that for a while.
And now
I have that back.
Now you have it back. Tell us about your involvement with the alumni group.
The alumni group is, like, awesome, and, like, you know, I didn't have it in, like, the beginning of my recovery, but, like, having it now and, like, seeing all these new people, like, come in, like, right out of treatment, like, it's such a safe place to go. And it's, like, an amazing organization. Like, I don't think a lot of, like, treatment centers, like, have, like, as big as, like, an alumni group as we have. And, like, we do things. Like, we were in Washington, D.C., like, a couple weeks ago. And, like, it was amazing. Like, it was so cool. Like, and, like, we have another thing, like, in Philadelphia. And we're all, like, going to go to that, like, as alumni. And we have a fall fest. There's all these events. And it's just so, it's a great thing to be a part of.
There's great, well, we know about community and we know about support systems and how important they are. But there's great power, Mag, in people who have shared an experience. It happens most recently, I guess, people sit around, where were you on 9/11? Mm. There were a lot of that going on. It's almost immediate that everybody has something in common here. That's part of the strength of an alumni group, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like almost like that snapshot memory that, you know, what was your detox process like? Like, everybody can go right there. They go exactly where they remember. And then they can laugh about the silly situation that happened with the CA or something that they did in rec therapy or something like that.
And this is more than sharing memories. There's something obviously very strong and therapeutic about this. Sarah, thanks so much for sharing your story with us. We appreciate
absolutely
that. And continued success with your sobriety.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, Sarah.
Mag, thanks once again.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And please look for us on Recovery Radio every Saturday. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.